I'm excited to be joined today by Dr. Kevin Mitchell. He's an associate professor of genetics and neuroscience at Trinity College Dublin. He's the author of Innate, How the Wiring of Our Brains Shapes Who We Are, which we did an episode on about 2 years ago in one of the early episodes of the Nature and Nurture podcast. And most recently, Kevin has authored Free Agents, How Evolution Gave Us Free Will, which we'll be talking about today. Kevin, welcome back to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Kevin, you explain in your book that when people ask the question, do we have free will? The answer really depends on two loaded terms built into the question, how you define free and how you define we.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of the debate around free will, it often starts with people making some kind of a definition about it and then using that as a criterion to say either free will does exist or it doesn't, or it could exist or it couldn't, even in principle, or some kinds of beings may have it and other kinds may not. But ultimately, yeah, you can't really understand what that question means until you understand both the free will part and the we part, because being itself entails, I think, some constraints. And so part of one of the ways that people define free will is a really absolutist way. They'll say, I can have free will to do whatever I want if and only if there's no prior cause whatsoever that's constraining what I do. Otherwise, I'm not free, in that I'm not completely free, so I'm not free at all. That's often the sort of philosophical way of putting it, which I find a really sterile and pointless approach to take, the idea that we should just define something in that absolutist way, which really defines it out of existence. Because if you think about it, you know, the idea of free will is that we can do what we want for our own reasons, not that we can do things for no reasons. And reasons are causes, right? They're constraints. To do something for a reason is to be constrained, to be informed by whatever that reason is. And I think that actually the idea of a self that isn't constrained by those kinds of reasons, that arise due to prior causes, or indeed for future desires, that wouldn't be a self at all, right? It wouldn't entail anything to be a being that is just doing random stuff all the time for no reason. There'd be no kind of continuity to that being that would constitute selfhood. So to me, it just feels like a mistake to try and define free will in that absolutist way, which not only could no being have it, no being would want to have it because it would just be a random behavior generator, basically.
It was really eye-opening to me that even if you hypothetically had this blank slate where you have absolute freedom at the beginning, then your first decision becomes a prior that constrains you, so long as, again, like you said, you're defining this agent as something that is consistent across time.
Yeah, if you have any goals whatsoever that last for anything longer than the moment of the present, then you have some constraints, right? If you're acting for a future goal, then, and you're doing something based on decisions that you've taken in the past, it's basically your past self informing your present self to do something in the service of your future self. So it just becomes a kind of a nonsense to think of a being that would not have that sort of relationship. That's the relationship that entails being a being through time. Right? That's what selfhood just is, constraint. There's nothing else to being a self than being constrained to act in the service of yourself.
The title comes in perfectly here because you're talking about free agents. And by agents, you mean causal agents and you mean life. And in the book, you trace back basically our entire evolutionary history, beginning to the earliest, what would you call it, bacterial life?
Sure. Yeah. The idea there is to look at the debate around free will, which has always centered on human beings. Right? And it's always confounded by all sorts of other factors, right? Especially moral responsibility, right? So usually the debate around free will is driven by a desire to protect our sense of moral responsibility in some way. So to protect the validity of applying praise or blame or reward or punishment for people's actions. It's basically the foundation of all civilization, of our legal systems, of our social relationships, and so on. People want to look at those systems and say, how could it be right that we can assign moral responsibility for things, we don't have free will. And free will looks like it's under threat from, say, physical determinism or neuroscience or behavioral genetics or psychology. So there's various moves in philosophy, typically ones called compatibilism, which claim to be able to protect a sense of free will worth wanting, as Daniel Dennett would say, which is one that basically allows us to protect moral responsibility. Now, from my view, moral responsibility is an extra thing, right? After the question of whether or not we have free will, what that means for moral responsibility is another step. And it engages all kinds of aspects of morality, of pragmatic collective decision-making, the evolution of those sorts of properties in hypersocial systems and why they exist and so on. For me, that kind of confounds the issue. And then in humans, it's also confounded with questions of consciousness. And when we say, are we in control? Does that mean, is it only apply to my conscious mind when I'm consciously deliberating about something? Or am I also doing something when I do it in a more automatic, habitual kind of a way? So those things get really confused in a lot of the debate around free will. And really, if you think about the threats to free will, especially from things like the idea of physical determinism, they apply not just to humans, to whether humans are in charge of their actions. They apply to any organism. How can any organism be said to do anything if physical predeterminism is true, for example? And so really what I wanted to do in the book was to recognize the challenges in talking about free will in humans, but then back off and say, look, to understand what we mean by that in humans and to get a grasp on the basic concepts that we're playing with there, why not go back to the very start, to much simpler life forms, and ask, how do they do something, right? Because that's the main difference between living things and non-living things, is that living things can act. They do things in the world. They are causes in the world. They're not just acted upon. Things don't just happen near them or in them or to them. They do things. At least it seems that way. And so there's a really fundamental question. How could that be? How could living matter, when it's organized in a certain way, have the power to act and to do things when non-living matter can't? And so what I try to do is go back, and it involves going back to the origin of life itself, ask, what does it even mean to be a living system? And then to think from there, how can we naturalize the concepts that we're going to need to understand free will in humans? And those are concepts like value and purpose and meaning, and ultimately the things that ground choice, that create reasons, that allow organisms to choose between options and so on. Yeah, so the book moves into this kind of consideration of agency as a defining property of life itself, starting with the actual origin of life.
Throughout the book, you're pitted against this view of reductive materialism, because a lot of people look at life and look at causal agents and say that it's almost more like a mechanistic computer, like they're just reacting to their environment or their internal processes. They're not really making decisions. And then again, you argue that to be an agent itself means that you're causally isolated from your environment or insulated from your environment. And then you can have meaningful causation that isn't just like mere nature-nurture reaction. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's multiple levels to that. But if you can start with really simple organisms, let's start with life itself, right? What is a living thing? It's a collection. It's not a collection of stuff, but it's a collection of processes. It's active. And then life is defined by these sets of, in our terms, it's chemical reactions. It shouldn't necessarily have to be, but it is. It's life is dynamical chemistry, basically. So it's sets of chemical reactions that in some sense are sort of self-enclosed, right? They constrain each other in order to keep that pattern going, and they generate the constraints that enable that to happen. So this is going back to theories of what's called autopoiesis by Matarama and Varela and many others, where it's a view of life as persistence of a pattern through dynamic flux, right? So rather than persisting by not doing anything and not changing, it's persisting by changing all the time and by taking in energy, by doing work to stay out of thermodynamic equilibrium with the environment. So that's what it is that sets living things apart from the rest of the world. And of course, living things as we know them now have a boundary, a physical boundary, whether that's a membrane or a cell wall or the skin of a multicellular organism, for example, that separates them from the rest of the world. So living things have to strive. They have to do work to persist. And that gives some really interesting things that never existed before in the world. And one of those is purpose. And it's a totally circular thing in the sense that living systems that tend to persist better, do things that persist better, will persist better, right? Completely sort of circular argument, but that's how evolution works, right? So living things are selected for configurations that allow them to keep persisting. And that was true even before genetic evolution happened, just in terms of physical systems. So that gives a purpose, right? It gives a normativity to the activities of organisms and what's going on inside them. For the organism, from its point of view, it's better to do things that enable it to persist. And that's just because natural selection says the ones that persist stay around for longer, like the ones that behave in those ways. So that gives some purpose. And then that grounds that grounding and value. So an organ that's trying to persist, there's lots of different ways it could do that. One of the ways it could do that is just sitting there, take the environment as it comes, maybe do some internal adjustments of metabolism and so on, depending on what's out in the world. But another thing you can do, another good trick, is to move around. Maybe the environment changes. Maybe it's not as welcoming as it once was. So maybe it's a good thing to move. And then it becomes useful to know where to move. Should I go left? Should I go right? Should I go north or south? And that means that getting information about what's out in the world becomes useful. And there may be things that even a simple bacterium, it's useful for it to tend to go towards a food source. And it's useful for it to tend to go away from a toxic chemical, for example. So those kinds of policies, the control policies, get configured into the system of the biochemistry of the organism in such a way that it will tend to approach or avoid attractive or repulsive things that are good to go towards or bad to go towards. Really, what that means is that an organism, even a simple thing like a bacterium, has some options, right? It can move one way or another. It can not move or move. And it controls which of those options it executes, depending on what's out in the world. Now, there's a couple of ways to look at that. One is the way that you just described, where you can say, look, we know what the mechanisms are. We can see there's this receptor, it binds this chemical and it sends a signal. This protein gets phosphorylated and then that one and that one. And ultimately the flagellum of the bacterium, which is like this sort of outboard motor, either turns this way or it turns that way. And that determines the direction of movement of the bacterium. And that's true, right? There is a mechanism. Of course, this choice depends on a mechanism. However, that's a really simplistic view of what's happening there, because in fact, you can do controlled experiments in the lab where you confront the bacterium with just one signal at a time. But that's not how nature presents itself to living organisms, right? It's not so accommodating. So it's presenting all kinds of things at the same time. The bacterium has to make sense of all sorts of stuff that's in the environment, and it has to use that context to determine what to do, right? So there's all kinds of conditionalities that are built into the biochemistry of the organism. So yes, it should go towards food unless the temperature is too high or the osmolarity is different or the cell crowding conditions are different or there's other chemicals outside. So in reality, even a simple decision like go this way or go that way of the simplest organism that we know, simplest free living organisms that we know, these bacteria, is already an integrative, holistic kind of exercise that I think is quintessentially agential, right? It's the agent is doing something. It's wrong, I think, to think of the agent as being pushed around either by something outside it or by its own components, right? It's a collective, holistic exercise that's happening there.
How do you push back against the argument that evolution really isn't purposeful, but it's running on autopilot? Like this is almost a predetermined outcome.
I think evolution is not purposeful, right? So it doesn't have any foresight. There are some constraints on the way evolution can go based on just the way physics works and so on. But there's no sort of cosmic drive to it. But what evolution generates is organisms with purpose. All right. So once you have organisms whose job it is, tautologically speaking, is to persist, then you have a purpose. And that anchors these things of meaning and value and so on. So yeah, the whole sort of direction of evolution is an interesting question. And really the tack that I take in the book is to look at evolution along our lineage, right? And that can give a kind of an illusion of directionality. Like it's this unidirectional increase in complexity that's ultimately having its fullest expression in our conscious minds, right? And I did that because it was ultimately the question of free will in humans that I wanted to get at. But there were all kinds of other ways that evolution went. There's nothing inevitable about that. That just happens to be the trend that went on our lineage. But there's all kinds of other ways evolution went that are equally successful. They just took a different tack. I mean, you know, E. coli continues to be super successful organism. Grass does very well for itself, for example.
I didn't see this explicitly mentioned in the book, but has Carl Friston's theory of active inference shaped your thinking about consciousness and decision-making at all?
Yeah, not what was interesting. So I thought about including something about the free energy principle in the book, which is a really fundamental mathematical principle that's been expounded by Carl Friston and colleagues, which is a way of thinking about what organisms are doing almost in thermodynamic physical principle in terms of perception and decision-making and generally of maintaining themselves. And you can make an argument, you can express a lot of the things that I've been talking about, like having goals and choosing between them and having a purpose and meaning and so on. You can express a lot of that in the mathematical language of the free energy principle. I didn't in the end go into it because I felt like that translation into that mathematical framework didn't add anything to the story that I was telling. And I felt like it would take a long time to explain the mathematical framework, which is just a parallel way of describing things, really. Yeah. So in the end, I didn't include it, but I'm very aware of it. In general, I think the pre-energy principle is a useful tool for describing the way that living things basically have to come to predict what's out in the world in order to persist robustly in dynamic environments. And so the systems, any system, this is true of physical systems as well, in dynamical environments, they also will come to embody some sort of model of things that are in the environment or that have been in past environments. So it's a really fundamental kind of physical principle. I just felt it didn't really deepen the understanding that I was going for.
Most of the math goes over my head, but I think it would be worth diving into this concept of entropy. So you do introduce entropy when you're defining life. You talk about Schrodinger's definition of life, that life is anti-entropic, not in the ultimate sense where entropy is always increasing in the universe, but life is a causally insulated system that consumes outside energy to basically maintain homeostasis and not fall into thermodynamic equilibrium with the rest of the environment.
Yeah. And I think you just did a really good job of explaining that. And it's a tricky concept because actually the entropy means very different things to different people. It means different things in physics than it does in some other areas. So it's a tricky concept, but basically what you just described is the sense that I'm after here, which is that living systems, these patterns of chemical reactions and all of the physical stuff that enables them, are organized in a way that is basically unlikely, right? If you leave them alone, they decompose really quickly, right? So it takes some energy to keep them constrained in the shape that they are, right? In the pattern that is them. That's partly why I was saying earlier, when we're thinking about selves, what does it mean to be a self? It's all constraint, right? It's just constraining all the bits to stay together in this way. And that means preventing them from being any other way. And since there are so many other ways, so many more other ways they could be than the way that they actually are, it's highly statistically and thermodynamically improbable for them to be in this particular way. That's why it takes energy to keep them like that. And that's what grounds this purposiveness, right? Anything that maintains that persistence, that unlikely pattern, is is good in terms of value for the organism, and anything that doesn't is bad.
I like that you're bringing up entropy in the statistical sense, in addition to the physics energy sense. So statistically, you talk a lot about indeterminacy in our universe, both like at the fundamental physical quantum level, and then also indeterminacy arising from noise that can just happen in natural complex biological systems. And there's this interesting, like sometimes the noise is useful, and then sometimes the noise is something that like our nervous system has to be robust to and essentially filter out with many layers of neural networks. Maybe we could talk about both the pros and the cons of that noise, like both when we use it to be adaptive and when we have to filter it out.
Yeah. And maybe I'll start by saying what sort of motivates that, which is the challenge of the idea of physical determinacy or physical determinism, which comes in two flavors. And I try to distinguish them in the book because I think they get confused a lot in this debate. So on the one hand, there's what I'll call physical predeterminism. And the idea there is that the laws of physics at the lowest levels of the laws that govern quantum fields of the evolution of particles and so on, things like the Schrodinger equation, are, some people would say, completely deterministic. And they leave no room whatsoever for any other causes to come into the system. They're causally comprehensive, to use the term that the physicist Sean Carroll uses. And if that were true, then we would be in this universe where everything that happens is completely determined by the current state of the universe, of all the particles and fields in it right now, plus the laws of physics determine the complete nature of the universe at the next time step, whatever that's taken to be. Now, if that were true, then you quickly can realize that would also state right here would determine here and here and here and here and here and here. And the state here would backwards determine the state that had been here. Basically, what that means is that everything that happens, everything I'm saying right now, would have been predetermined by the state of the universe immediately after the Big Bang. And there was nothing else was ever going to happen besides what I just said to you. Now, I find that absurd, but thankfully, physics generally doesn't actually say that's the case, right? There actually is fundamental indeterminacy in the way that quantum fields and particles evolve. So the Schrodinger equation is really deterministic in the sense of how it evolves, but until you intervene on the system, when I shouldn't say you intervene on the system, until something happens, there's some interaction that forces one outcome to arise, because all the Schrodinger equation does is actually give you a probability density function, right? It just describes a range of probabilities for, say, where some particle will be. However, when you actually want to know, or when something happens in the system that forces the particle to be in one place or another, then it seems like there's just some sort of random choice between those probabilities. So it's actually, physics would generally say it's not deterministic in that full sense. There's some randomness to it at the lowest levels. And so there's a couple sort of challenges to that. If we're going to look to that sort of level of quantum indeterminacy to rescue free will, if we think it needs rescuing. So there's two typical challenges. One is to say, that's just quantum stuff. We know that all that quantum noise averages out at the classical level of things like us. I've never really understood why that would be. We're still made of particles, fields, and so on. They're just, because they're together in something that we call an object, it's not obvious why their quantum properties should stop existing. But of course, it's true that they do get, those fields get entangled with each other and so on. So you can argue, okay, maybe these classical things don't have that same kind of level of fundamental indeterminacy. But there's another way of looking at this, which applies equally well to classical things. So people will say classical physics, like Newtonian physics, is completely deterministic. And that's what allows us to, say, predict when solar eclipses will happen hundreds of years in advance, or allows us to land rovers on the surface of comets 14 million kilometers away or whatever. These amazing sort of feats of astrophysics, especially. However, it turns out that's only true if you assume that the numbers that describe the physical parameters of the system that you're talking about are given with full infinite precision all at once. That's one way of thinking about the world. It's the way that has come to dominate mathematics, but it's not the only way of thinking about the world. There's a really different way of thinking about the mathematics of real numbers, which is known as intuitionistic mathematics, where actually their numbers are not given in full precision all at once. They're evolving processes. So they're given with some precision, but their far away digits, decimal point way down here, are not actually, they don't have a value yet. They don't have a truth value. They're not either more or less than 0.5, say. They could be or not. They're not anything yet. So they evolve through time. And in that framing, the future is genuinely open, because the numbers that would describe the parameters of the situation very far into the future are just indefinite. It's not that they're unknown. They just don't exist with that level of precision yet. They come to exist with level of precision as things in the future reach the present, and then they get defined. And there's some element that's a randomness to that, even at the classical. So sorry, this is getting to be a bit of a digression into some odd philosophy of numbers and, yeah, and physics. But the point is, both in terms of the quantum level and the classical level, you can make very good arguments that say the current state of the system plus the laws of physics do not, in fact, fully determine the next state of the system. There's some indeterminacy there. There's some indefiniteness in that. Now, there's another rejoinder to that, which is to say that doesn't help. It doesn't help me to have free will to say some things are determined and other things are random at the lowest level. I'm still not in charge of either, in either of those scenarios. I'm not doing anything. It's either the physics is doing it or it's just randomness. It would be a valid criticism if that's where the argument stopped, but that's where the argument starts, right? So the point is not that the indeterminacy drives your decisions, or that you in some way control what the physics that's going to happen. The point is that it generates some causal slack in the system, such that higher order organization can have some constraining influence over the way things happen, right? It doesn't change the laws of physics. Quantum fields and everything are still at play. It just means that when things are constrained, when the conditions are like this, as opposed to like that, different things will happen. So the configuration of the system can have causal power that's just as valid a cause as the low-level physical forces of atoms that are acting within it.
You hinted at this earlier. You spend more time writing about it in the book, this view of process philosophy, that the universe itself, we shouldn't be looking at things at a specific time point as like static objects, but it doesn't make sense to have any objects that aren't evolving.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm not a philosopher, but the more I read of the process philosophy stuff, the more sympathetic to it I am. And in its extreme form, it basically said there are no substances. There are just processes. And or processes are the fundamental ontological elements of the universe. And occasionally, there are some really slow processes that we recognize as objects, particles, substances, and so on. You know, I don't know if I need to go that far. I'm happy for there to be stuff and processes at the same time. I don't really necessarily need to privilege one over the other. But I will say that the idea, certainly of life, you have to take a process view of life. It is a process. It makes no sense whatsoever to take some static view of life, of a living thing, as being composed of a bunch of objects. It's not. The objects are moving through all the time, right? The atoms in you right now are not the same ones that were in you a day ago, certainly not the same ones that were in you a year ago, and yet you've persisted, right? So the pattern persists, even though the stuff is going through it. And that pattern is a pattern of processes. It's a pattern of dynamics. So the dynamical view of life, which is really in keeping with process philosophy more generally, I think is the right one. It's the one that anchors idea of purpose and value and meaning and demystifies them, right? It doesn't make any sense for objects to have those things, but in relation to processes and dynamics, it makes much more sense. And I think too, in terms of a self, the only way that a self, the concept of a self makes sense is in a process philosophy kind of a way. It's a process that has continuity through time. There's nothing else it means to be a self. So yeah, I'm very sympathetic to those views. And I find, yeah, they can get you out of wrong ways of thinking. At least that's been my experience. And I'll add that there's another kind of philosophical view, which is really a relational, the idea that the properties of things are not intrinsic to them. There aren't private properties that become expressed in relations to other things. It's the opposite way around. It's the nature of the relations in basically give the properties of objects and substances. And again, I would say the same thing for living organisms and for cells, that it's the relations that we have with other beings that gives our biographical self its nature and its continuity through time.
In the same way that you describe how it's become fashionable among neuroscientists to take this reductive materialist view and deny free will, it seems fashionable among some physicists to take an argument that the universe is essentially a simulation. The most extreme example I know of this is Max Tegmark's mathematical universe hypothesis. And I'm seeing a lot of parallels here between that and this process philosophy, almost as if the universe is like rendering when you're talking in the video game sense, when you're talking about the future is indetermined and then it unfolds and there's some level of mathematical uncertainty, but then the values become plugged in. And not only that, but in a video game, if it's a type of like first person game where you have a character, as you move your character, you move into unrendered space. And as you start moving in a direction, your computer starts loading the rest of that scene in that direction. And it just, to save computational resources, it doesn't load anything in the opposite direction. And I'm wondering if there's any meaningful parallel there between that and what of, like you mentioned with quantum indeterminacy, it's only once there's some meaningful interaction does the particle like take on a fixed value.
Yeah. I think there is, not that I'm at all in favor of the idea that we're living in a simulation or anything like that. But I think, first of all, I think in terms of the indeterminacy and the idea that the future is open and basically the physical parameters are indefinite in the future, that's what makes it the future. And the present is the time point at which interactions force those indefinite parameters to become definite. I think that fits with me much better than the kind of arbitrary supposed threshold in spatial extent, where that supposedly is the some kind of criterion for a transition between quantum behavior and classical behavior. That just seems really arbitrary, right? There's no principled reason to say, okay, when it gets this complicated, that it's classical or this complicated. It just doesn't make much sense. Whereas to say that through time, things become definite in this kind of just-in-time reality, right? I think that's right. And it's like a just-in-time economy where we're only ordering what we need and we're not stockpiling stuff that we might not need. I think the universe is like that, not for the same reasons, not for any reason. I think it just is that way, but it's an interesting way to think about it. It means that you can, to my mind at least, derive a kind of a satisfactory position, which allows you to expect, first of all, that the laws of physics are what they are, but that doesn't entail everything about the future being predetermined from the dawn of time or from any point in time.
You write about how if we did have causal predetermination, then time becomes this arbitrary thing where a cause can happen before its effect, but at the same time, if everything can only go in one linear fashion, you could easily just go in the opposite direction. But then there's something, again, about the indeterminacy that we've been talking about that seems dependent on time, and even more fundamentally, life dependent on time, moving in a certain direction.
Yeah, there's some interesting metaphysics here, because if you think about the what's known as the block universe, which Einstein argued for, among other people, that the direction of time doesn't really mean much in that scenario. You can go forwards or backwards. You can predict forwards or backwards. It doesn't really make any difference. If there's only one line, then there isn't really a direction to that line necessarily in the block universe. Fortunately, I think that picture of the block universe is just not right. And I think modern physics has shown us that's not right. So the indeterminacy, you're right, though, it gives an interesting directionality. And people have often talked about that, the idea that actually the direction of time comes from the second law of thermodynamics, basically, which says that things will tend to get less ordered rather than more ordered spontaneously. And that means that, yeah, the events will tend to go more in one direction than another. So that's very contested, I think, and the nature of time, the origin of the directionality of time is all highly contested. I quite like Lee Smolin's kind of view of it, which I described in the book, of this idea of things becoming more definite, and then that just defines the past. That's basically what the past is. If events have happened, and now that's what that was like, and then other events will happen as stuff in the future sort of arrives at the present moment, if you will. For me, that makes more sense. And I guess for the purposes of the book, was the physics and sort of metaphysics stuff, the point that I came to, I guess, was just being satisfied enough personally that physics doesn't say the future is predetermined and we can move on from there in terms of trying to understand the biology of choice and decision-making without feeling like it's all folly, like it's all just pointless because the physics is just going to happen. What the atoms are going to do, what the atoms are going to do regardless. I think that's not the case. I think atoms in living organisms are constrained to do things in different ways, just like water in a pipe is constrained to behave in different ways than if it were not in a pipe. So it's not magic. It's just...
This is a great tie back into entropy and free energy that we were talking about. Without going into any of the math, there's two ideas of how entropy minimization comes into life and what consciousness is doing from like a computational perspective. So on one end, there are some scenarios that you talk about in your book where we essentially default into letting the brain's random processes make our decisions when those decisions are inconsequential. And then on the other hand, in terms of entropy minimization, you talk about these hierarchical neural networks, and basically some low-level details can be averaged out or filtered out as you move up the network. So then I was thinking about this again from Friston's active energy or free energy principle idea of, if the goal is to minimize entropy, minimize computational expenditures, then it makes sense for inconsequential decisions to just let it be decided by randomness and not have to waste time thinking about it. And it also makes sense for consequential decisions to just boil down everything to bare bone abstractions when possible.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple ways to think about that. So for the complicated where it does matter, but we need to think about what to do, which is most of the decisions that we face, where there's not just one thing. It's not just an isolated choice like psychologists like to give people in the lab or neuroscientists. They're faced with, here's a scenario, there's all kinds of things I could do, and I need to optimize over that range, right? Over that search space of possible actions. I need to pick the one that has the highest utility, I guess, in whatever, over whatever short range, long range, medium range set of goals I have in mind, right? So you can think of a lot of the brain circuits involved in decision-making as a nested hierarchy. And there are circuits that are involved in just making a motor action. Right? So really moving a finger like this or that kind of thing. But then there are circuits that are levels above those that are involved in deciding to do something. Like you just decided to take a drink, right? Now, the decision to take a drink is different from the decision to move your arm in such a way as to take a drink. So the motor action is contextualized by the goal of the behavior. And in fact, the behavior, choice of the behavior, was contextualized by the goal of not being thirsty. And that's contextualized as well by the broader goals of having a good podcast where you're not constantly drinking because you need to ask questions. So you've got nested kind of goals, and each of them is providing some context to the levels below that will inform the way that level will settle into some kind of outcome. If you imagine there's some competing options here for either an action or a goal or a policy or whatever. So I think it's a powerful way of thinking about behavioral control. And in fact, you can, in an evolutionary sense, it built up in that way, right? The simplest organisms just have this sort of motor control. I'll do this or do that, right? Very much, very kind of pragmatic control policies based on what's out in the world, simple decisions, approach, avoid, explore, exploit, and so on. More complicated one, these longer kind of time frames over which they can judge between different kinds of behaviors and juggle short versus long-term goals and so on. Yeah, I think the free energy principle framing is another way of saying that. It's a way of describing that mathematically, which is that the top-down signals constrain what the lower level populations will do, informed by the information that's coming from the bottom up. And that seems like a reasonable way to describe a lot of cognition. And for me, the important thing is thinking of cognition as a system, part of a control system, right? It's there to control behavior. The point of cognition, point of more complex cognition and goal directedness over longer periods of time, is to better control behavior in a way that's more predictive, that gives organisms more flexibility, more power over themselves and their environments over longer time frames. That's the evolutionary trajectory that led to the kind of level of behavioral control that we have, ultimately kind of conscious cognitive control. Yeah, I think those ideas of constraints, if you want to talk about it in terms of free energy minimization, I don't think that's incorrect. It's fine. It doesn't add anything for me to the story as I wanted to tell it, but I think it's another way to phrase things or frame things.
I did a recent podcast with a postdoc studying decision neuroscience at University of Oregon named Ben Smith. And one of the things we were talking about is that both in the actual human brain during decision making and in evolutionary time scale, you see this spectrum from posterior to anterior, from more concrete neural representations to more abstract. So the idea is that when you're thinking about more concrete movements, how do I move my arm to pick up the cup? Then it's going to be like a more posterior, I guess, tied to more basic brain regions that are controlling the sensory motor processes. And when you're thinking about something abstract, not just about like, how do I move the cup, but why am I doing this? Am I drinking? It gets more anterior. And that seems to be paralleled onto the evolutionary time scale. First, you learn to survive, and then only later do you start thinking about survival.
Yeah, I think that along similar lines, and it's a simplified way of putting it, I don't want to over-egg that, but I think generally speaking, that trend is true. And you can think about it both in perceptual terms and in sensory motor output terms. So what I just talked about was the in motor output terms. So if you look from the side at the primary motor cortex will be here, and then supplementary motor areas or premotor, and then ultimately into prefrontal areas. As you go more anterior from that midpoint of the those areas are concerned with things for longer time frames, right? So they're not just concerned with an immediate motor action. They're concerned with a behavior or a goal, a longer term goal, and ultimately very long term goals and more of the prefrontal cortex. And these are the areas that we need that are involved in long term planning and executive function and the ability to forego immediate gratification in the service of longer term goals and so on. And yeah, you see the same thing in perceptual systems. So we have, if you go from the back of the brain forwards in our visual system, for example, then the primary visual cortex, the cells and their responsive orientation or different color or so on, or things that are moving in one direction versus another direction. And other areas, right, higher levels of that hierarchy survey that information that's there in the primary visual cortex, and they draw inferences, higher order inferences about the patterns of things that are causing that those neural activities. And they become interested in edges and objects and then types of objects and then specific things like faces or houses or tools or so on. And then ultimately you get to the point, you have parts of the brain that seem to be concerned with concepts, right? Your dog, but the idea of a dog, right? Even linguistically, the idea of a dog, the properties that a dog may have relative to other things, right? The concept of dogness is something that is more abstract. And once we get to those levels, then we can really think about things, right? Because then we can think about this relational aspect that I was talking about before. The properties of a dog are relational properties. right? There, it's furry. What does that mean? If you touch it, it feels like this. It means it's four legs. They can bite. There are things. What we need to know about them is, what can I do with that? What can it do to me? And what can it do to other things in the world? What are the causal relations that it has with other things in the world? And that's how we ultimately have a cognitive understanding of things in the world. So when we are making decisions, we're bare on the world. We're assessing what's out in the world in the context of everything we've learned about how the world works. That's stored in our brains, right? But it can't be reduced to just that neural configuration. It's instantiated in that, but it's not just that, right? It's meaningful relations. So that's really the key point there, I think, because you could talk about all this neuroscience. We're learning all this great, amazing neuroscience of how these things work in our brains and in animal brains and so on. There's a temptation, I think, to just, as we're learning all this mechanism, to say, it's just mechanism, right? It's just the neural circuits firing. It doesn't really matter what they mean. These circuits fire, that's going to happen. These circuits fire, that's going to happen. It's a very reductive view. And that's one that I'm trying to resist and argue against, because while there is a neural mechanism at play, what I argue is that it's the meaning of those patterns that drives the mechanism.
On one hand, while you get more brain and more computational power, you get more capacity for abstraction and stringing complex thoughts together and projecting further into the future. On the other hand, there seems to be a categorically different type of thought that emerges at some point, which is metacognition. You devote a whole chapter in your book to metacognition, and you offer a couple speculative comments. One is something like, perhaps as you grow in complexity enough, it becomes inevitable that you start thinking about your own thinking. And the second one is, perhaps that metacognition is what gives rise to subjective experience. Because a question that a lot of people ask and that undertones the book is, even if we can describe life as causal agents and we can describe cognition as this computational process instantiated in the brain, why do we feel like we feel anything? Why is consciousness itself not just epiphenomenal?
Yeah. And there's a reason that's called the hard problem. And that's the reason why I left it really to the end of the book. And I don't spend a ton of time talking about consciousness, partly because I'm left not knowing what that qualitative experience adds necessarily. So in terms of metacognition, it's easy enough to see the value of it in terms of a control system, right? So if you were building a robot and it was able to see things in the world, recognize objects, understand causal relations between them, represent some goals that it has, represent its internal states, and make some kind of overarching optimization, decision-making across all of those states and all that information, then it would be doing cognition, for my mind. And if you added to it the ability to represent its own confidence in its own beliefs or certainty in its perceptual inferences, for example, which is really what metacognition is, then I think it would be a better control system. So I think just in control theory, it's a value to metacognition. So now, what's harder to get to is the obvious value of there being a subjective experience to that, right? Or you could have it. Is your robot now experiencing something? I don't know. Like, this is what I was speculating on. Maybe that just would entail a kind of a qualitative subjective experience. If it's thinking about its own thoughts and it can now reason about its reasons, maybe that just feels like something. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But I think in terms of metacognition, there's another obvious value to it, which is apparent in a social species like ours, a hypersocial species, which is that if I can think about my own thoughts and I can think about your thoughts and I can tell you my thoughts, right? And I can tell you my reasons for doing something. I can persuade you to do something because it's a good reason to do it, right? That becomes a really valuable part of our social cognition. I think it's really what separates us from other organisms, actually. And there are certainly theories by Fritz, among many others, for example, that it's precisely that kind of social cognition that led to our abilities for metacognition. That's where the value comes from. Maybe metacognition in an isolated animal that never can talk to anybody else isn't so useful. Maybe it's really a social phenomenon. So yeah, the tricky bit, right, is the question of why does it feeling like something, does that give you anything? What's the value of the feeling like something? And I don't know the answer to that. I think there's multiple ways of thinking about it. You can completely reverse it. You can completely reverse it that actually feeling like something is the very basis of subjective about, and then it feels like something. It's that the very basic control systems in the simplest organisms, these approach avoid systems, inherently feel like something because it's good to persist and it's bad not to. There's an argument to be made there. I don't see that there's an empirical way to dissociate those or figure out what's right. It feels like a metaphysical quandary. Yeah, and ultimately, however, the point that we arrive at is that we do have metacognition. We can think about our own thoughts, right? When the objects of our cognition are not just things in the world, goals and states and so on. They're beliefs about those things, beliefs about our beliefs. We can reason about our reasons. That gives us a level of cognitive, and an extra level of cognitive autonomy. We have greater autonomy, greater agency because of those abilities than simpler organisms that can't do that. That's the argument that I would make. The fact that they're conscious, it's just a little harder to figure out what the implications of that are for this story about free will.
What do you think of people like Antonio Damasio, who have argued that affect is fundamental to consciousness? So when you're talking about approach and avoidance motivations, that you don't get those without some sort of inherently positive or negative experience associated with it.
Yeah, I think so. Antonio Damasio would be similar to Mark Solms, I think, in making that argument. And it makes a lot of sense to me. Again, it feels really hard to dig into that in any kind of empirically testable way. I'm not saying it's not right. I think it probably is right. It's just not obvious what follows from it necessarily. But I think that I absolutely think that the origins of decision-making come from value-based policies, right? As we talk about in bacteria, it's configured in such a way that a certain signal means avoid. Right? The signal doesn't mean, oh, there's high temperature over here, or there's a nasty chemical. It just means avoid, move away. Mm-hmm. It's an imperative kind of internal signal. And so I very much am of the view that cognition got scaffolded up from those kind of pragmatic control policies to include internal representations, which were more flexibly manipulated in terms of a cognitive arena or a cognitive economy, but that was a process of decoupling from immediacy of things in the environment, as opposed to the traditional sort of philosophical question of the grounding problem, which is we have these internal representations. How does the meaning get added to them? No, like evolutionarily, that they started really meaningful for the organism. They got decoupled. They got detached from that meaning.
Yeah, I promise I'm not trying to shove free energy down anyone's throat, but I have heard Mark Solms, it's an axiomatic claim. The claim is that increased entropy is inherently felt as negative and decreased entropy is felt as positive. And you could see the survival motivation there if that was indeed the case. And then if that's the case, then you get a nice computational framework for how you can stack these different motivations. Again, you have to just accept it at face value at the beginning. So maybe that's a limitation there.
I think that's another way of saying that things that will encourage persistence will be favored. Right? Basically the same thing, which is the argument I'm making as well, that that's where value comes from. It has to be normatively anchored to something, and persistence is what it is anchored to. One of the interesting things is that you can build on that basic idea to say that actually there should be selection for organisms to be better able to predict things in the world, and that actually the drive in the nervous system is a drive for greater predictability. And so the signals, the learning signals that the nervous system is getting, that are reinforcement learning, are basically, yes, you're in control. Things are going as you did, right? Keep doing what you're doing. Those are good things to do. Or things are a bit out of control. Your predictions are not working out so well. So we need to reconfigure somehow and not just relearn maybe particular things, but shift the whole kind of a strategy or raise the temperature, increase the search space of options or so on. So I think there's some really interesting formulations there that go into some of the computer science area of learning algorithms and so on that can be framed in that way, that there's a utility function for predicted power, that what organisms are trying to do is predict themselves with more and more accuracy into the future over a wider and wider range of environments, or possible environments, actually. And if you want to frame things in that way, I think it's a sort of a parallel way of saying technically the same sort of thing that I've been arguing for.
This seems like a parallel to the idea of degrees of freedom as well. We began the conversation saying, if free will doesn't mean absolute freedom, what does it mean? And clearly some species, like humans, can have more free will than any others. Then the interesting thing is that also implies that some humans can have more free will than others.
Yeah, and I think the really clear, and in fact, it's why in our legal system, we have different degrees of responsibility that we recognize. Right? So in the simplest form, babies have less free will than adults do. Right? They have a smaller range of possible actions that they can do. They have less control over themselves and their environment. And the only thing that they can do is scream for their parents' attention. Right? Now that turns out to be very effective, but so free will is something that emerges through time. It's a capacity. It's a skill, right? It's a learned skill. It's conscious cognitive control. It's what we call executive function. At least that's what I'm arguing. And executive function comes along with maturity and experience and so on. And some people have it to a greater degree than other people. And that's true. It's obvious when you're talking about babies versus adults. It's also obvious if you talk about people with mental illness like schizophrenia, for example, who, if they're having a psychotic episode, have less free will, I would say. They have less conscious cognitive control over their actions in the moment than someone who's not in the grip of psychosis. And you could say the same for dementia, maybe, if you want to talk about the ability of the self to maintain goals over long time periods. Well, people with dementia have less of it. But also it's something that we recognize between people. A lot of our personality traits or character traits refer to this ability to control yourself, right? Whether you're impulsive or prudent, whether you're temperate, which means you can temper your emotional reactions to things and prioritize longer term goals and so on, whether you're conscientious and have foresight and so on. A lot of the character traits that we recognize are really referring to the capacity for self-control, the capacity to regulate your emotions, as often in a pro-social kind of a way, the capacity to put longer-term goals in, prioritize them over short-term ones, and to engage in planning effectively over time frames and so on. So, yeah, I think the degrees of freedom clearly exist. And some people might say, look, no one's completely free because they're wired this way, or circumstances are like this, or they're just made like they're an impatient person, or they can't help being anxious or whatever. All of that is true, but all of that I take to be evidence for the existence of something that we recognize as free will. Otherwise, what are you talking about? What is it that you think is varying between people if not this capacity that is the phenomenon that we want to explain?
Are the moral consequences of this degrees of freedom view of free will different from compatibilism, which essentially is deterministic and says that free will is like this useful metaphor?
My view of compatibilism is that it's a cop-out. It's a bit of a fudge, basically. So it tries to argue that even if the world is physically deterministic, we are so complicated that we're in essence unpredictable. And we can be considered the source of things happening. So even if I wouldn't have done otherwise in similar circumstances, right, my choices were actually determined, I might have done otherwise if I was configured in a different way or if circumstances had been different. So it's still me. It was still the causation was still coming from me. Now, I don't really buy that for several reasons, but one of them is that I don't even see how you would ever get agents that you would be debating whether they have free will or not in a universe that's completely physically deterministic. Because the whole point of living things is to harness that indeterminacy in the universe. That's where we make a living, literally, right? That's where living things can exist, is in those places where the organization of the system comes to have some power that enables the whole thing to persist. That weren't true. If there were no possibility for variation in those things to occur where someone was better than others, then life for me wouldn't exist. Greedy, in the sense that as a philosophical argument, it assumes the existence of people like you and me, and then it argues that even if physics were deterministic right now, we would still be blameworthy or praiseworthy for our actions. Yeah, so I've never really been convinced by it, and I find it odd, partly because you don't have to buy into physical determinism because it doesn't seem to be true. So I don't see the need for a compatibilist view, but also in terms of the question that you asked, compatibilism basically just defends our current system of moral responsibility and legal responsibility and says that's all fine. We can still keep treating people as if they have free will, even though they don't really, and it's a wink. Whereas I would say our current system of moral and legal responsibility is all fine because we actually do have.
When you're talking about degrees of freedom and levels of free will, do you treat it almost as a formula where you can plug in or out different variables? For example, a legal defense that you might see, you mentioned this in the book, is if people have a certain genetic predisposition for aggression or something. And I know that some of the studies you mentioned might have been statistically questionable, but let's assume we're talking about one that is legit. Then it's almost like your default human, like just not plugging in genetics, just assuming maximum degrees of freedom. Once you plug that in, the degrees of freedom go. Is that the way you would think about it?
Yeah, it's tricky. So first of all, I don't think of degrees of freedom as just on a single line, a single continuum, right? I think mm-hmm. there's spaces of freedom that may be qualitatively different from each other, and that can vary with both with external circumstances and situations, as well as internal factors that are either things like my genetics and the other aspects of my past experience, or current things like whether I happen to be intoxicated or not. That can affect my degrees of freedom and my ability to control my behavior and so on. And we recognize that as well. So there's all kinds of factors that can come into ascriptions of moral and legal responsibility, and that just as a pragmatic matter, of course, actually do, right? That's what a lot of legal system is concerned with, not just whether someone did something or not, but how much responsibility should be assigned to them based on, are they a juvenile? Were they under the influence? Were there mitigating circumstances in their situation? Whatever. It's interesting that genetics and neuroscience is starting to enter the courtroom in those kinds of arguments. People are putting forward these genetic profiles and so on that say, look, I have the high risk variant of this gene or that gene. Ironically, one of the variants, the genetic variant that we know of that has the most common variant that we know of that has the biggest effect on aggressive behavior is the Y chromosome. It has a huge effect on physical likelihood of physical violence. Massive. There's no other behavioral genetic effects like it. But nobody really takes that to be a mitigating factor in court, right? You can't just go in and say, look, I'm a man. What can I do? I'm violent. Or you don't get very far with that. So I think our systems are able to deal with those kinds of things, although they can get a bit bamboozled when you add in new shiny genomic technologies or brain imaging or so on. That I think it's easy to put some bells and whistles in there and make it all look sciencey and so on. I personally don't find a lot of those arguments very compelling. A lot of them, as you mentioned, are based on really bad scientific studies, even ones that have made it into the courtroom. So it's an interesting area. It's one that I think is going to be really fast developing, will continue to develop as we have more and more sort of genomics of behavior that emerges and more people are these polygenic scores that reflect various traits and so on. My hope, there may be some rare cases where it is worth taking into account. There are some mutations in particular genes very rare that do seem to predispose to really violent behavior. Is that exculpatory? I don't know. I'm not a legal scholar, so it's really hard to say how those things should be viewed.
You argued that in large part, free agents is defending our current intuitions about free will and moral responsibility, just grounding them in science. But then, as you mentioned, there are some types of limitations or constraints on our degrees of freedom. One just being, as we know, being male means, on average, being more likely to be aggressive, and then at least during development, slower developing, worse at inhibitory control. And these things you could technically plug in and use to, let's say, lighten sentencing or moral judgment, but we don't. And another one, the most obvious, would be IQ, which is that higher IQ might mean more predictive power, more inhibitory control. Actually, I don't know if those are associated, but in general, more long-term planning in a way that could improve your free will and then make you more morally responsible. And we do that in our legal system and morally when we're talking about extreme cases of low intelligence, like to the point that we think it impairs your functioning. But people seem reluctant to look at individual differences and say that we should be judging blameworthiness based on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. So first of all, IQ, other measures of cognitive functioning generally do tend to correlate with measures of executive function, right? Sort of planning, working memory, how many things you can keep in your mind, how many parameters you can cognitively operate over at the same time and optimize over and so on. So there is some overlap between those things. And it's absolutely true that some people are better at those kinds of aspects of executive function than others, right? They're more patient, they're less impulsive, they plan better, they're more prudent, they're more temperate, and so on. And yeah, it's a bit of a circular kind of a thing, because the behaviors that tend to get people in trouble are the ones that aren't like that, generally speaking, unless you're doing a real sort of prospective psychopathic kind of behaviors that are really planned out in advance. But yeah, so as far as the sort of exculpatory aspects of it, or I don't know what to think about that. Should we view people who should really know better as more responsible when they do something? I don't know. We do that for children, right? Relative to children, when they're older, we do say, you should have known better. It's not your little brother's fault. You both did it. Your fault, because you're older and you should have known better. So we do employ that. I don't know that it's employed in the court of law. It's certainly employed in the parents' court, but I don't know about otherwise. But what's interesting, though, is that people sometimes look at the literature from behavioral genetics and they say, look, all these personality traits, conscientiousness, neuroticism, extroversion, things like that, are partly heritable, at least. So our genes, the genetic variants that we inherit, are partly determining the way our brains are wired. That's what my previous book was all about. And those predispositions shape our behavior through our lives. And that's true, but it really gives a faulty or a false impression if we take those links to be too deterministic and too proximal. So it's true that genetic variants influence those personality traits. And it's true that those personality traits, predispositions, influence our behavior, but neither of those relationships is deterministic and it's not proximal or direct. So it's not just like the tunings of a robot right now, my extrovertness controlling what I'm saying right now, or my neuroticism or whatever, right? Most of our behaviors are habitual adaptations to our experience over our lifetime. And of course, the way that we adapt to our experiences is informed by those predispositions. And those shape the way our character emerges and the way our habits emerge and our policies and our attitudes and also the projects and commitments that we take on over our lifetime, where we take on our job, where we get married, where we become a parent or whatever it is. All of those things continue to shape behavior into the future. One of the things I wanted to do in the book was to move a little away from impression predispositions. I was pushing back against the idea of a blank slate, which is nonsense. But even though we do have these predispositions, that doesn't mean that they control our behavior. We're not controlled by those. Right? Our character emerges through time, and it does so as the result of the choices that we have made through our lives, which include the choices of how we think we should behave over time. So I think we have a lot more say. Yeah. So do you want to start it again? We have a lot more say in the way our character emerges, and the way our behaviors, the way our brain is configured right now, is not just the result of passive genetics and passive experience. It's the accumulated result of choices that we've been involved in our own, through our own agency throughout our lifetimes. So the idea that someone could say, right now, my brain is configured a certain way and I didn't have anything to do with that, I think that's just wrong. We do have a lot to do with it over our lifetimes. We're not completely in control of it, but we're also not just puppets at the whim of other things happening in the world. Some things are up to us and some up to us.
That's a great optimistic note to end on.
Okay, great. Then I'm happy to leave it there.
Thank you very much for your time, Kevin. And when it comes out, everyone be sure to check out Free Agents, How Evolution Gave Us Free Will.
That's super. Thanks a million. It was really fun.